You set the stage and then go.
Okay. Okay, let me ask you a question. We're getting off to a real late start. This is the last class before lunch. Is that right? Folks, let me ask you a question. Does your schedule permit us to run until about 12 or maybe 10 minutes after 12? Will that be okay for people? Okay, we're going to run a few minutes after 12 on this session, and if we do, and if you need to leave, please feel free to. I'm going to start kind of quickly right now and give him an introduction on this thing. Then I'm going to jump up to where we were. But we are probably right now marking time. We're probably about 50 minutes from being completely finished, okay? So if you have to leave, I understand. But here goes. To help Dave Gaylor out, this is for the tape. This is our first session on the No Debt, No Sweat Get Together. This is the session where we're going to talk a little bit about the need versus greed issues with our money. And we have, as you know, already in this class, we've had some microphone trouble. In this class, what we've talked about are the two great truths that really are fundamental to understanding how to deal with our money. I've made the point that the first great truth is to realize that things are not the way they appear to be. The truth is up to 70%, actually the number is 72% of Americans are struggling with money. And the hard reality is Christians are probably at even a higher level than that because we tend to be people of the mass. There are a lot of Christians who really do believe that going to church is that exercise on Sunday mornings when we come, emotionally cross our arms for about an hour, look at the head in front of us, and then turn around and go home. And if that is our concept of Christian koinonia, Christian fellowship, then we are never going to get to the point where we can sit down with another couple or with another individual and say, hey, you know something? I haven't given anything to church in 6 months. The bill collectors are calling all the time, and I'm sitting bolt upright in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about these bills. So we are not the people that we appear to be. Now, that was the first point I made. The second point that I made was simply this. Things are, or I should say it this way, there's always only one best way to do anything. No matter what you're talking about, there's one best way to do it. Now, there may be a dozen or 50 different ways to accomplish a goal, but there's always one best way. Today, I want to talk to you about the fact that you're not alone. Number two, the best ways of handling money. Now, with that said, what I had also done was talk a little bit about Bonnie's and my background. And I'm going to hit this again real quickly under sort of the heading that things are not the way they appear to be. I don't want to teach material and be a hypocrite. I don't want to stand up here and pretend that I've got answers and that I'm living a life that I'm not really living. The truth is, I do practice what I preach for the most part. But I can tell you that for the first few years of Bonnie's and my marriage back in the 70s, we didn't do very well. Back in the late 1970s, like I told you, we were up here in debt. We had a bucket load. We had the school debt and the car debt and the credit cards and all that stuff that was just messing up our lives. So going into the 1980s, Bonnie and I got really jazzed about this thing. We determined, hey, we're going to figure out how to overcome this thing. God began to work with us. And I, like I said a while ago, believe that this was a God thing. God began to put this on our hearts. Going through the 80s, we started changing some things. God led us. We learned some principles. And by the end of the 1980s, for all practical purposes, Bonnie and I had stepped totally out of debt. We had paid off our car. We had even, as I told you, paid off our home. Life was better. So going into the 1990s, I got more excited about this. I started learning more about it. As I mentioned a while ago, the Bible has more than 2,350 passages dealing with money. One out of every eight things that Jesus talked about had to do with money or materialism. And I became a student of economics and of investing. And through the 90s, I started to learn something. I started to learn, hey, Bonnie and I, we're not the only ones struggling with this. This is not just epidemic. This is pandemic in the church. Listen, like I said, this is the most aggressively hidden sin in the church today. People will talk about divorce and remarriage. We will talk about internet pornography. We will talk about the instrument or not the instrument. We'll talk about all that stuff. But nobody wants to stand up and say, hey, I'm fighting over my money. I'm scared to death and I'm in trouble. People don't want to do this, so we aggressively try to hide this sin. So going through the 90s, I was becoming more familiar with this, working with more Christians. I had a publisher in the mid-1990s that came up to me. He knew that I'd written two or three other national books, and he said, Steve, what do you think about writing a book called No Debt, No Sweat? And it would be like the definitive book. This is the book. He said it would be the definitive book. We would talk about everything. We'd talk about how to get Christians completely out of debt, not counting their home, in 1 to 4 years. How to develop a budget the right way. How to get husbands and wives to quit fighting. What to teach the kids. How to become the givers that God wants us to be. How do you do practical things like home buying, car buying, insurance? How do you invest for retirement? How do you save? How do you pay for college? How do you do all of these things the way the Bible teaches? Well, I thought, you know, that's a great plan, but the trouble is, I, at that point, was busy. I was running a large business in Nashville. I simply did not have the time to do this. So I told him, I said, I just can't do it. Well, at any rate, in 2000, God blessed us. We sold the company, and the elders at the Antioch Church of Christ in Nashville, where we've been members since the 1970s, they came to me and they said, Steve, would you like to become an elder? And I said, no, I don't want to be an elder. And they said, well, and I guess sort of as a consolation prize, they said, Steve, why don't you think about coming on staff here and develop this ministry? Well, I'd wanted to develop the ministry. I don't have a lot of respect for these lone wolf ministers that you see out here running around the country that have no accountability to anybody. So my thinking had been, well, I'll just start a 501c3 corp and have a board that I would be accountable to. But when my nine elders came to me and they said they'd like to oversee this, I thought, well, great. I mean, these are my best friends. They know me, and that'll work. So today, I am a full-time staff minister at the Antioch Church of Christ. The joke is, I'm the only minister there that doesn't go to church there, because usually I'm traveling sharing this ministry, this message around the country. But I can tell you that as this began to develop in 2001, I started writing the material after I'd come on staff in Antioch. And one of my elders, as I was writing No Debt, No Sweat, came up to me during 2001 and he said, Steve, have you ever tested this material? Do you know if it even works? I said, well, no, I guess I don't. I mean, it worked for Body and Me, but we haven't tested it empirically. He said, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about us just teaching this material here at the Antioch Church? What about trying it out on our own people? We're a church of about 800 or 1,000 people. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So in 2001, as I was writing the No Debt, No Sweat book, we began to teach this material. And we had folks all through the church, people that were getting out of debt. We had people who were giving more than they'd ever given. We had marriages that were tightening up. We offered this to the community. And the cool thing we found was that this was like we call it the Jesus paradigm. People really came to this. You know, here's our problem. I don't know about y'all, but in our church, what we were finding, we'd baptize somebody, and then in 6 weeks, we were wondering where they were at. Well, you know, we started looking at the way Jesus did things. Jesus built relationship. He built a culture within a person's life. He got involved. He would heal. He would feed. And then he would teach the spiritual side of things. Well, we realized that if we would offer people help on a level that they perceived a need, they would come. And it worked. Well, at any rate, in 2002, when the book first came out, I thought, well, we'll do a few seminars. And I remember one of my elders even asked me, he said, Steve, how many of these could you do each year? And I laughed and I said, well, I hope to do 10 or 12 a year. Well, it's been 5 years this month. We actually announced this at the Tulsa Workshop in March of 2002. It's been 5 years since we did our first seminar. And this, as I mentioned, as of today, I think is our 236th No Debt, No Sweat seminar. And folks, this has nothing to do with this message. It has this messenger. It has everything, though, to do with the message. This is a wide, broad, and deep need within our fellowship. So at any rate, in 2002, thanks to some really nice people, the word kind of got out. The Christian Chronicle and people at Harding and Abilene. Harding has used this as a for-credit course now and around the country. The word just sort of started to get out. And we got real busy doing this. So at any rate, that's how this ministry has sort of grown. And through this experience, I have learned, as I was saying earlier, that people are not the way they appear to be. I told you I wanted to get back to this a moment ago, and I want to right here, right now. The truth of the matter is, we aren't what we appear to be. And until we start to realize that, and until we start to believe that God has some answers that we don't have, we're never going to change anything. You see, the world has got all the solutions. You think about it. The marketing people in our world tell us how to have happiness, right? All we have to have is three things, right? Stuff, sex, money. Those are the three things that marketing people tell us we have to have. And I'm telling you, if that were true, the happiest families would all be out there in Hollywood. But we Christians keep falling into that same trap. Chuck Swindoll said this. He says, listen, the church has gotten to be way too much like a bag of marbles. And you think, well, what's wrong with marbles? They're all in there together. Well, they are, but the trouble with marbles are hard. They're rigid. They bang their way through that bag. Instead, we probably, as Christians, as God's kids, we probably need to work on being more like a bag of grapes that are about a week old that you forgot and left out in the trunk. You ever done that? You go and you pop the trunk and you think, oh my stars, and you reach in there and you pull them out and you look inside that bag, and what you see inside that bag doesn't look like a very beautiful bunch of grapes anymore, does it? It looks more like an oozy, congealed, runny, blobby mass of something. And it's kind of hard to tell where one grape stops and the next one starts. Now, that might be a little bit gross, but folks, I'm telling you, that's what we Christians need to be more like. We need to be more like a bag of grapes. We've got to get involved. We've got to get invested in each other. So if this morning you've walked in this room, and I don't know your background. Some of you may be elders. I know that people come a lot of times. They want to listen to this and consider doing one of these seminars for their churches. I'll be glad to talk to you about that. But I also know that there are people in this room right now who are probably struggling. If you've come into this room, and if at this very moment you are just simply sick and tired of being sick and tired of money problems, if you're sick and tired of having too much month left at the end of the money, I know how you feel. If you're sick and tired of robbing Peter to pay Paul, or Betty, or Fred, or Ethel, or Ricky, or Lucy, or somebody else, I can dig it. I know how you feel. If you're sick and tired of renting your life instead of being able to buy your life, I've been there and done that. If you're just, like I said, sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired, I promise you have come to safe ground here. Because what we're going to be talking about in here for these next three mornings is how to do it right. We're going to be talking about how to overcome some of these things and how to bring the life skills, the money skills, and the God skills all together that need to converge to make this kind of thing happen. And like I said, I am not interested in teaching what the world teaches. Y'all know what the world teaches, right? And the world essentially teaches this. The world teaches that if we want to be happy, we've got to, like I said, have the same three things. More stuff, sex, and money. The world tells us that we need to work on looking good. And everybody knows what looking good is, right? That's the three cars we can't afford, the house that's too expensive, the motorboat we're not using, and the designer clothes that we've outgrown. I mean, that's what looking good in America is all about these days. I'm more interested in teaching Christians how to live good with a paid-for home, a house that doesn't put us in the poorhouse, making spending decisions that our kids can respect, and having money available anytime one of God's causes comes along. That, to me, is what living good is really all about. I'm not interested in here in teaching on the concepts of bill consolidation. Now, the truth of the matter is, when I do the full seminar, and the full seminar is usually four sessions long, and unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do all four sessions here at Tulsa. What we're going to effectively do is portions of session number one and then session number two broken into two parts. I'm not going to even have time to get into session three where I talk about debt, how to get out of debt, how to deal with credit cards, how to get rid of your car loan and all of this stuff. Or session number four where I teach the six secrets of the world's great investors and how mutual funds work, the difference between God's investment approach and Satan's, and how to get ready for retirement. Not going to have time to talk about that. But normally I do talk a little bit in that third session about bill consolidation loans. But my point here is this. I'm not here really with any great interest in teaching on bill consolidation. What we're going to be talking about in here is the concept of bill cancellation. But to do that, what we have to understand is something real simple. And that's this. For many of us, the first step to true financial success is going to be through a very, very deep pit of failure. And now what does that mean? Here's what it means. Some of the most financially capable and some of the most financially able people that I know of today are the same people that in some cases, as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, were in the deepest pits of failure. But they made up their minds. They said, listen, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired of this stuff. I'm not going to live like this anymore. I want to develop the strategies, the skills, and the disciplines that it takes to get from where I am to where I need to be. I'll tell you what, let me illustrate it this way. Let's go back a few years. Let's go back about 50 years. 1958 was the year. 1958. It was a very successful time here in America. 1958, that was the era of the baby boom. We just won the war. America was feeling her collective oats. It was a very successful time here in America, but not for everybody. 1958 was also the year when the Ford Motor Company introduced a brand new car that it told us was going to be the innovative niche filler for an entire generation. But there are not a lot of us today who would associate the word success with the name what? Edsel. But Ford didn't start out planning to fail with the Edsel. I mean, everything about this car was cool. I mean, there was that push-button transmission control system in the center of the steering column. The name was special. It was chosen from over 8,000 names that were entered by the Ford employees, the ad agency guys, even the famous poet Marianne Moore. She entered some names. And everywhere you looked in 1958, there was promotion for this car. Louis Armstrong, Frank Sinatra, Rosemary Clooney, they were all singing about this car. This was 1958. This was the year when cool things were happening. That was the year that Billboard magazine started its first Hot 100 chart. Pat Boone, the Meguiars, Elvis Presley, the Platters, they were all racking up hits. 1958 was the year that the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants both grand slammed their way out to the West Coast. 1958, that was the year that America entered the space race with the launch of our first Earth satellite, Explorer 1. 1958, that was the year that shows like Danny Thomas and the Tales of Wells Fargo and Bonanza were all capturing our attention in the evenings. It was a time of success, but again, not for the people at the Ford Company. It was a dismal time for them. The truth of the matter is, Mr. Ford made a film where he said, "America, I'm proud to tell you that the Edsel is here to stay." But it didn't work out that way. One person described the Edsel sales chart as looking like a dangerous downhill ski slope. Every month, the sales were getting worse. Nobody could figure this out. Some people said, well, the reason the Edsel's not selling is because the Edsel's too big. Maybe that was the problem. You know, the big, bold, bombastic cars from the early 1950s, by 1958, had begun to give way to smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. I think it was 1959 when that ugly little car from the fatherland hit the sandy beaches of North America, and we were all driving Volkswagen Bugs for about 10 years. Maybe it was too big. Other people say, no, it wasn't the size. The reason the Edsel didn't sell was because of the price. Well, maybe so. The Edsel did cost more than other cars in its category. Other people say, no, it wasn't the size, it wasn't the price. The reason the Edsel didn't sell was because the Edsel didn't work. The hoods didn't close, the trunks didn't open, and that fancy transmission, that thing never lived up to its mission. Well, folks, I don't know why the Edsel didn't sell, but I do know that after three incredibly disappointing years at the Ford Company, they finally shut down production on the Edsel. Now, again, you may be thinking, well, Steve, what in the world does this Edsel thing have to do with me? It may not have anything to do with you. You may be part of that 25 or 30% of this group that are doing just fine financially. And if you are, we're going to be talking to some degree. Actually, the truth is, I'm not going to have time to get into the fourth session as much as I would like to, but we will be talking about some of the things that will be of interest to you. In the full seminar, I teach on mutual funds. I teach about what to teach our children about money, how to become better givers to God. But on the other hand, you may be part of that 25 or 30% of this audience who really are struggling, and you can identify with Ford. I mean, just like Ford, they didn't start out planning to fail. You didn't start out planning to fail. But sitting here right now in March of 2007, you do not feel successful. I mean, you had started your young adult lives out expecting surely by this time of the year this time of life to have some money in the retirement account, by this time in life to have some money ready for college, to be on your way towards a retirement plan. But for some of us, that great American dream long ago morphed into something that feels more like a gothic nightmare. That things have just not worked out the way we'd hoped they would. Some of us can identify with these things. I know I can. Some of us really do know what it feels like to sit bolt upright in bed in the middle of the night, not having a clue how we're going to pay those bills. We're afraid to answer the phone because, boom, every time we do it, it's another collector. You've ordered another credit card because all the others are maxed out. You dread talking with your spouse about money because every time you do it, boom, it ends in a fight. Leading cause of divorce in America today, our money troubles. Gallup Research just came out with new studies on this. 56% of divorced people say that the number one cause are money troubles. And again, this is the most aggressively hidden sin in the church. It's unbelievable how many people are struggling with this. Even when we go to church or we go to a ball game, and our minds should be focused on what we're doing, we find our thoughts drifting back to the money things that we're struggling with. And maybe the saddest one of all is at the bottom here. Even when a good cause comes along, something you want to give money to, something that you believe in, you just don't have anything left to give. The question is, well, what do we do about this? Well, what I encourage us to do is to simply understand the Ford story. You see, here's what happened at the Ford company. When this debacle with Ford happened, Ford made up their mind, hey, we are not going to sit in a pity puddle and feel sorry for ourselves. We're not going to sit here and give up the ship. What we're going to do is we're going to develop the strategies, the skills, and the disciplines that we need to get from where we are to where we want to be. And I'm telling you, we can do the same thing ourselves as Christians today. You see, to do this, though, we have to understand something important, and that's this. We are all like fish in a barrel. I don't care who you're talking about. Everybody out there already has a plan for your money. I don't care whether we're talking about the retailers or the telemarketers or the credit card companies or the banks, real estate people, insurance people. Everybody's got a plan for your money. And the plan is real simple. The plan is to come over here to your billfold and suck all of that money out, right? And bring it over here and drop it into their corporate coffers. Now, I'm not saying that these are bad people, but I am saying that if we don't get smart, we're going to spend the rest of our lives at the end of every month sitting at home feeling dumb and stupid, wondering, what happened to my money? I mean, retailers, they study us. Retailers know, for instance, when you walk into one of their stores, more likely than not, you're going to make an immediate right-hand turn and do a counterclockwise sweep through that store. That's why smart retailers frequently put their highest-priced, most profitable items in that sweet spot immediately to the right-hand side of the front door. And have you noticed over the last few years how the shopping carts in grocery stores seem like they're on steroids? They keep getting bigger and bigger. Have you noticed that? It's because the studies show that people like to try to fill up their cart. So, duh, let's give them a big one. And have you noticed that there are fewer hand baskets in the grocery stores than there used to be? Same studies show that when a hand basket gets heavy, people go to the checkout line. They know that for every 1 minute you spend in that grocery store, you're going to spend $2.50. So they want you to get behind one of those mega cruiser shopping carts and go up and down the aisles for a couple of hours. Retailers, they know that you will spend more money, that we will spend more money on a product that's on a shelf at body or eye level than we will for an equally good one that isn't. This box of cereal usually retails for something around $4. This bag of cereal, on the other hand, which is essentially the same stuff, and by the way, there's more in here than there is in here. This bag of cereal, where is this shit thing usually at? Yeah, right down here on the very bottom. You've got to put on a helmet and a miner's light and go speed lunking, and voila, you come up with a bargain. I mean, they know how we tick, they know how we think, they know how we operate. Insurance people, they know that scare stories sell insurance policies. Let me read you something from Brian Wainsick. Brian Wainsick is an expert in retail marketing, and here's what he has to say. Brian Wainsick says that people like stores that have a lot of variety, and people perceive a store to have a lot of variety if there is a certain degree of jumble and a lack of predictability. By the way, if anybody has your cell phone still turned on, be sure you pop it off if you will. People perceive a store to have a lot of variety if there is a certain degree of jumble and a lack of predictability. Folks, that's why when if you go into a TJ Maxx, you're likely to find socks in a bin right next to picture frames. A while back, Bonnie was out of town. It was supper time. I said to the girls, I said, what's for supper tonight? And the girls said, well, we could have soup and sandwiches. And I said, great. They said, Dad, the problem is we don't have any soup. Would you mind to go get some? I said, sure, I'll be glad to. What do you want? They said, we need 2 cans. Get some kind of vegetable soup and get some bean with bacon. I'm a big boy. I know how to do that. I said, sure. So I went down to the Kroger store near our house. I parked the car. I went inside. And suddenly, I'm hit by this wall of red and white striped cans. I'm in Campbell's land. Well, the thing is, these cans are not in any logical or predictable order because they want me to look at everything. I didn't understand that. I thought, beans with bacon. I'll just go up here to the bees. They weren't alphabetized. And I'd done something else dumb that night. I'd gone into the store hungry. Don't ever do that. Bad plan. I'm telling you, I stood there for the most part of 5 or 10 minutes hunting for those two stupid cans of soup. And that night, folks, I came home with those 2 cans plus 5 more because everything looked so good. I mean, real estate people, they know that if they get into the house first and pop some cinnamon buns in the oven, you're going to be more likely to buy the house. And seriously, think about it. How many cars do you suppose have been sold on payment plans that lasted longer than the car? I mean, folks, that's the reason banks have drive-up windows. It's so our cars can see who owned them. That is bad financial planning. See, folks, we have a problem in America today. We have a problem that I call America's closet sin. Some people call it materialism. Some people call it consumerism. I call it stuffaholism. It's that attitude of ingratitude that says, hey, L'Oreal is worth it, and I deserve whatever I can get. And that's what gets us into trouble. The truth of the matter is that Jesus had his own phrase for it. Jesus called it being in love with this present world. It's that attitude, again, of ingratitude that gets us into trouble. And this leads us to these financial pains that we have. We have the financial pains. We try to hide them. We hope that other people don't find out. We pop on the mask because, after all, we are people of the mask, right? We don't want to admit these things. Things go from bad to worse until finally the bottom falls in, and what we had hoped would remain a private situation suddenly becomes very painfully public. Listen, let me just share with you two things about God that I am totally convinced of. And again, I'm not proud to tell you this because honestly, this doesn't make me feel good to admit it. But I grew up, I spent a lot of my life honestly believing, and I'm not proud of this, but believing that God was sort of the great cosmic killjoy. And he was just kind of looking for ways to take fun out of life. And brothers and sisters, I'm telling you, that's not our God. God really is on our side. He loves us, and he's pulling for us. Two things are true. Number one, as long as Steve Diggs denies or excuses any sin in my life, I'm going to continue to fall farther and farther behind. And number two, there really is strength in numbers. And this gets back to what I was talking about a while ago. This is where churches need to link up and build cultures where they go further and they teach. And by the way, when we do the No Debt, No Sweat seminar for churches, we have a wonderful follow-up study called the No Debt, No Sweat Money Boot Camp. It is a 10 or 13 week study with all the videos, the CDs, the workbooks, all of the materials that allows churches either on a Wednesday night or a Sunday morning or in a small group context to go deeper into this. But this is where culture gets built. We've got to understand there's strength in numbers. James may actually have known what he was talking about when he said to pray for, confess your sins one to another and pray for each other, because the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man does what? It avails much. It does a lot of good. Here's my point. My point is this. Folks, people that are struggling financially are frequently in a state of denial. And I'm not talking about the river in Egypt, okay? I'm talking about a broken, dysfunctional, painful way of living. Today, the average Christian is spending or is giving God just a little more than 2% of their income. God is getting a little more than 2%, while in many cases, Christians are now spending up to 20% paying off credit cards and short-term debt. That means that MasterCard's getting 20% and the Master's getting 2%. That's bad. That's the problem that we have. The devil knows all this stuff and he loves it. Folks, these are not happy, clappy facts, but these are the facts of the matter. This is the truth. It is of 2005, for the first time since the Great Depression, Americans are now spending more than they're making. We're now spending over $2 trillion a year using credit cards. That's more than we're spending on with cash and checks combined. Credit card debt has doubled in the last 10 years. The money experts are telling us that, as I've already mentioned, money problems are the leading cause of divorce. And moms, dads, we're doing a great job with our kiddos. The average kid that comes out of college comes out with anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000 of college debt. And I need to update this. Brand new stats have just come out. They're coming out with up to $5,000 of credit card debt. And again, I don't have time in here to teach about the way they go after our kids. Now, in the full seminar, and when we do a seminar for a church, I urge churches to make sure their teenagers are present, because we've got to get in front of our teenagers' faces. They are trying to sell debt to our kids these days the way they used to try to sell hamburgers to us. It's wrong. As of the 1990s, less than 10% of college kids had credit cards. Today, over 70% of kids in college have credit cards, and the average kid that has one has 5 credit cards. And more of these kids are using their long-term college loan money to pay off their monthly plastic bills. This is what's going on, and we need to teach these kids about this because it's destroying their lives. If these kids don't do a U-turn in a New York minute, many of them are going to be coming out of college with so much debt that they will never be able to get it paid off. They will never be prepared for their own retirement or their kids' needs, or to give to the church of tomorrow. And listen to me carefully on this. There are churches all over America who think, hey, we're meeting our budget, everything is fine. But when they really study it, they find that a hugely disproportionate amount of that money is coming from people that are in their 60s and 70s and 80s. The people that are in their teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s have never learned how to give. We have got a train wreck about to happen in this fellowship if we don't begin to mentor and teach our young people and our middle-aged people. Now, again, let me go back. There was one more thing I wanted to mention here. By the way, the average family today has about $12,000 of credit card bills. But there's an interesting stat here that I really like this one. There's now a study out that shows that fully 27% of Americans are convinced that the best shot they have of ever winning or ever having $1 million is to win the lottery. Now, folks, I'm just going to tell you something. I'm not a very politically correct guy, but here goes. Christians have got no business messing with state lotteries. And why do I say that? It's because state lotteries are gambling. Well, what's wrong with gambling? Gambling is a predatory behavior. There's no way for one person to win without someone else losing. And that's not the way a Christian ought to tick. Listen, if I'm not being blunt enough, let me just say it this way. State lotteries are a tax on the stupid and the broke. That's what they are. The reality is your odds of winning a major payout in a lottery are less than 1 in 8 million. There's a better chance that a flea will go in your right ear and come out your left eyeball singing Dixie than there is that you're going to win a big payout in a lottery. But people believe this, and this is what gets us into trouble. The truth is, most anybody that follows the No Debt, No Sweat plan, if we will do it correctly, can retire with most of, if not more than $1 million. But there are right ways and wrong ways of doing this. Now, again, I started to say this. When I have a problem, and I've illustrated some problems here, I like to find somebody that has a solution. And for me, one of my great heroes was a guy named Vince Lombardi. How many of you all in here remember Vince Lombardi? Yeah, these are football people. Back in 1970, September of the year, that was when Vince Lombardi died. But when Lombardi died, he was the winningest coach that the NFL had ever had. Lombardi had led the Green Bay Packers to 5 NFL championships, to 2 Super Bowl wins. This guy knew football. Story goes that at the beginning of practice every season, Vince Lombardi would get his squad together and get these guys seated. And Lombardi, he was a little short, fat guy. He would kind of waddle over here to his duffel bag and reach inside and pull out a football and walk over in front of these guys, and he would begin practice this way. He would look at him and say, "Gentlemen, before we start practice this season, I want to introduce you to the item I am presently holding. This is what they call a football." And that was where he began practice every season, because he wanted to make a point. He wanted these guys to understand that he did not give a rip if they knew all the plays in the book, understood all the nuances of the game, or even had all the plays in the other team's books memorized. He knew that they weren't going to win very many football games until they got the fundamentals down, until they had the basics between their ears. And it's exactly the same with money. We have got to understand the fundamentals. And I want to share 4 quick ones with you right now. Number one. If today you're struggling with money, you're not alone. I've already said this about 6 times. I'm going to keep on saying it. You're not alone. You're with about 70% of the people. By the way, people that are in debt believe 3 things that are wrong. Number one, they think that they're all alone. You're not. Number two, they feel hopeless. You're not. I promise you, virtually anybody that follows the No Debt, No Sweat plan can get completely out of debt, not counting the house, in about 1 to 4 years. And number three, people that are struggling with their debt feel, just simply put, they feel stupid. They feel dumb. It's amazing how often when I'm in a conversation with a couple about their money, at some point they'll just stop and they'll say, "Steve, I just feel so stupid." Listen, being dumb and being in debt are 2 radically different things. And again, I'm not going to have time to talk about a lot of this stuff, but those are the 3 false beliefs people have. The second fundamental, though, that we have to remember is this. There are some productive things that we can do to get from where we are to where we want to be. But thirdly, just by way of truth in advertising here, I've got to tell you, we didn't get where we're at overnight, and we're not going to fix this problem overnight either. Folks, it's been a little over 15 years ago, February the 7th of 1992. I was 39 years old when they wheeled me into St. Thomas Hospital in Nashville. And before they let go of me, they had done 5 heart bypasses on me. And folks, I'm telling you, I was one scared guy. I mean, I had spent 39 years doing everything wrong. I was as big as a blimp. I mean, you could have written Goodyear on the front of me and got me into ball games for free. I mean, I was totally out of control. I did nothing right. I mean, I got no exercise. Maybe on a good night. I might like roll over in bed a time or two, but I got no exercise. I was doing everything wrong. And here I am a few weeks after the surgery, laying around the house feeling sorry for myself. How many of you in here have had bypass surgery? Anybody? Okay. Do you remember, by the way, there's nothing to bypass surgery, is there? I mean, it's very simple stuff. They just saw you open, they do the plumbing, they hit you with some baling wire, they tell you to go home and pray a lot, right? I mean, that's really about all there is. Well, anyways, I was at home praying a lot. This is about 3 weeks after the surgery, and it was during what I call the period. You remember that period before the bones heal back up? And every time you move, they rub against each other and they go. Well, this was the period for me. Anyways, I'm laying around the house feeling sorry for myself. I'm thinking, wow, I've got this world-class wife. I've got 4 great little kids. And here I am with 5 bypasses? Well, anyways, back in those days, all 4 of the kids were at home because we homeschooled them. By the way, I don't usually talk quite this fast. I know I'm going at about 600 words a minute with gust up to 800. But I'm trying to get caught up from the time we lost earlier here. So forgive me for this. But at any rate, I had to wait till Bonnie and the kids got down to the other end of the house. We had 4 kids, and we homeschooled all 4 of them, so they were really at home all the time. And then I snuck back up here to the bedroom, and I went in the closet and pulled on some shorts, put on a T-shirt and some tennis shoes. I had a plan. I was just going to get over this thing. I was just going to go out and start jogging until I got over it. So I snuck out the front door, started jogging down the driveway. Got down to the street. I don't know, maybe got 200 yards or so down, and the weirdest thing in the world happened. The sky started to go round and round in circles. I went down on the side of the road like a bucket of rocks. I was in real trouble. Well, like I told you, Bonnie's my best buddy. She knows me pretty well. A little while later, she kind of popped her periscope up, and she started looking around. I wasn't where I was supposed to be, so she got in her car, and she came a-looking for me. And I'm telling you, folks, there was that magical marital moment when Bonnie's car crested that hill and her eyes met mine. Boy, she was mad. I thought she was going to roll over me and kill me dead. I mean, she was ticked off. But she pulled down there, got me in the car, we got home, and we got through that mess. But I learned an important lesson from that. I learned that I wasn't going to fix 39 years of bad behavior in 39 days. Now, God's blessed me. I haven't had a steak in 15 years, but God lets me run 4 miles at a whack 3 days a week. I feel great, and things are going wonderfully. But it takes a plan and sustained effort. Number 4, and I don't make very many guarantees, but I'll make this one. By getting back to basics, I guarantee that we can have a much more successful future than a lot of us have ever dreamed possible. Now, one of the things I want to touch on, and unfortunately, I don't have time right now to talk about this like I wish I could. If we were going to do the full seminar, the 3rd session, when I talk about debt, I talk about borrowing money. Because today, as you know, there are 2 broadly different viewpoints within Christian circles about borrowing money. We all hear the name it and claim it guys on the radio. Send me $1,000, God's going to give you $10,000. Just, you know, play God like he's a cosmic slot machine. He wants you to be rich. Say the prayer. Borrow the money. I disagree with this. I think that this is a greed-based theology. But on the other side of the coin, we have Christians today out here that are telling God's kids that all borrowing is sinful, that you should never even own a credit card, and on it goes. And I think that this can be wrong too. Folks, the Bible, to my knowledge, nowhere tells us that all borrowing is sinful. And again, I wish we had time, and I'm not going to be able to do it here at Tulsa. But in the 3rd session of the regular seminar, I share with you what I call the Jesus paradigm of borrowing. How to borrow money, the rare times when it makes sense, and how to do it so that we cannot get into a financial or a moral dilemma doing this. But I will tell you this, the Bible over and over again warns about the dangers of borrowed money. Proverbs 22 is a favorite go-to passage for me. Just as the rich rule the poor, so the borrower becomes the servant or the slave of the lender. And you say, well, what do you mean servant? Well, the better word here really is the slave. That's really what it translates out best to. And you say, well, I'm not anybody's slave. Are you sure? I mean, when we're being driven by the payment book, when we're being driven by worries about paying the bills, I would submit to you that we are slaves to the money, and we don't need to be in that predicament. Let me give you 2 quick things to think about before you borrow money. And again, I do this with apologies to those of you in here. There are a few of you in here that have some gray hair on top. And I've noticed that those of you from that generation got this stuff right, okay? Those of us who are baby boomers, and then the Gen Xers and Gen Yers and the millennium kids, and all of those that came after you, we did not get this stuff correctly. So I'm apologizing to the gray hairs in here, okay? I've noticed that there's a direct relationship between the amount of gray hair on top and the amount of gray matter between the ears. And you guys got it right. But for those of us who are younger, I want to share two very simple points, very few syllables, very short sentences that hopefully we will understand. Before Steve Diggs borrows money, I need to do something. I need to ask myself the question, Steve, what is your motive? Why am I borrowing this? You know, a lot of our borrowing, folks, gets done because we don't trust God to provide. Sometimes there's an element of greed involved. Jesus warned about this. He said, watch out, be on your guard against all forms of greed. Why is that? It's because a man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of his stuff, his possessions. First cousin to this thing is a little thing called vanity. That's what gets us into a lot of trouble. Hey, real fast, let me ask you a question. What do you think is the most expensive thing you'll ever buy? The most costly thing, real fast. Somebody. A house? Kids? I've heard college, cars, kids. Right now, the average car loan is 63 months long. The average car payment is almost $400. And when that's gone, there's going to be another one. But that's not the most expensive thing. Somebody said a house. The median price on homes right now in America is standing at about $210,000. Now, I know some of you live in places where it's three times that much and others live in places where it's less. But that's the average, the national median right this moment. I wish I had time in here to teach on home buying. There's a whole section in the No Debt, No Sweat book on it. But let me just say this quickly. If you're thinking about buying a house, remember this. 30-year mortgages are great. If you're a realtor or a mortgage banker, they're not great for homeowners. Think about it. Suppose you're going to borrow $200,000 on a 30-year mortgage, okay? And depending on where interest rates are, let's just pretend that your monthly payment's going to be $1,000. Now, intuitively, we would think that if we went from a 30-year mortgage down to only half as many payments in a 15-year mortgage, that $1,000 a month would probably have to jump up to about $2,000 a month. But it doesn't work that way. It would probably jump up to about $1,300 or $1,400 a month, and you, in turn, would save about $100,000 in interest. But it's not home. Somebody else said kids. They're estimating a kid born today is going to cost about a $250,000 to raise them up to age 18. And then mom and dad, if you choose to give them a college education, and on Saturday in here, I'm going to teach you a little bit about how to pay for college, and I do not agree with this whole thing that says if you hatch one of them, you owe them a 4-year college education. I don't believe that. I'm going to show you some alternative ways to pay for college in here on Saturday. But they're estimating that in 18 years, a college education, in many cases, will cost over $200,000. But it's not cars, it's not kids, it's not college, it's not the house. The most costly thing any of us will ever have is an out-of-control ego. Because it makes us do dumb things to impress people. And this is what gets us into trouble. Listen, I can't begin to tell you the number of times that I have bought stuff that I didn't even want with money that I didn't even have, to impress people that I didn't even like. That is a dumb way to do it. But I've been there, done it, got the t-shirt, the coffee mug, and the tattoo to prove it. I don't want to live like that anymore. First consideration again, before we borrow, is what is my motive? The second consideration before we should borrow money is to simply ask the question, what is my ability to repay? And you would think, well, that's pretty intuitive. I mean, everybody knows that they need to repay the money, but no, we don't. We live in a culture today that says, hey, don't worry about it. 90 days, same as cash. No payments till when? 2084? I mean, listen, folks, the news is this. 90 days is not the same as cash. The depressing thing about borrowed money is you got to give the stuff back. And that's when today's instant gratification becomes tomorrow's bondage. Folks, I have never been to a Red Lobster or to a Chili's or to an Applebee's or to any other restaurant that was worth it. Did you know if right now you have, say, $4,000 on your credit card of restaurant bills, and that's just about a half or a third the national average, and if you've made up your mind that you're going to pay that minimum that they're asking for each month, did you know that in most cases it will take between 20 and 30 years to pay that thing off? Folks, there are some of you sitting in here right now who have made payments this month on meals that you ate during the Reagan administration. That is bad financial planning. Listen, It's when we presume on the future that we get into so much danger and so much trouble. You know, Murphy's Law is Murphy's Law. Everybody knows what it says, right? If something can go wrong, what? It's gonna. One of the kids is going to need some weird exotic medication that the insurance isn't going to cover. A tree falls on the end of the house and we realize, oops, I've got that $1,000 homeowner's policy, that deductible. This is when we get into trouble. James warned about this. James said, now listen, you who say today or tomorrow, we're going to go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then poof, you vanish away. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live or do this or that. But as it is, you boast and brag. Everybody read this last line with me. All such boasting, it's evil. It's sinful. Folks, of all the people on the planet, we Christians are the ones who should understand the need to preact so we don't have to constantly be reacting. You know, the Bible tells us that life is unpredictable. Life is short. You know, one person broke it up this way. He said the first of those, well, let me just say this. You know, the Bible again says that the days of a man are 70. We know that, right? 70 years. And we do understand that that's poetic, right? We know some people live to be 90 and other people get hit by Greyhound buses when they're 50. But historically, 70 years has been pretty average. One person did break those decades up this way. He said the first decade, that's the decade of spills. The next one is the decade of school and drills, followed by the decade of thrills, to be followed by the decade of bills, which is then followed by the decade of ills, to be followed by the decade of pills, to be followed by the decade of wills. That's pretty depressing, isn't it? But folks, that's the truth. The hard reality is this. We're not going to know the day our coffin rolls into town or the day they cut the flowers that are going to go on top. But there are a lot of us who go on day after day, year after year, decade after decade, never ever really getting serious with the serious stuff. Folks, the bottom line is real simple. God is on our side. He's pulling for us. He's given us the owner's manual. He's told us how to find joy. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you've got, because He Himself has said, and praise God for this, I will never desert you, nor will I ever, ever forsake you. That's a promise from God. Listen, it's only when we understand these principles that we're, and by the way, this first session was just our Get Acquainted session. In our next two sessions, we're going to really get down and hit the ground hard running and cover some real deep information. But it's not until we understand these principles that we're going to be of any real use to other folks, to ourselves, or even to the kingdom work that God has called us to. You know, I used to hear people say something, and you've all heard it too. I had heard this, by the way, so many times that I'd gotten sick of it. I didn't even want to hear it again. This old adage about climbing the ladder of success, I just was worn out. I'd heard it and heard it and heard it. And I always thought of people climbing the ladder of success as people that were crawling over other people to get what they wanted. It dawned on me a few years ago, thanks to Stephen Covey, that that's not right at all. As a matter of fact, that every one of us need to be busy climbing ladders of success. Those of you who are moms, full-time, 27, you know, seven-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day moms, God bless you. Climb that ladder. Men, women, those of you that are in business, climb that ladder. Those of you that are in the ministry, climb that ladder. But here's what dawned on me. I got to thinking one day, Steve, what's it going to be like the day you get to the top of your ladder? And what's more, how will you know you're there? Will that be the day that I take my best friend to the doctor and I find that something has happened to Bonnie? That be the night the phone rings and we learn that something's happened to one of the children? Will that be the day that one of these things that comes and goes in my left chest comes, but it just doesn't go away? I don't know. But brothers and sisters, I can tell you this for sure. The day I do get to the top of my ladder is not the day I want to find out that my ladder has been leaning against the wrong building. Now let me tell you what to expect tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the ABCs of godly money management. The A is when we're going to talk about learning to acknowledge who it is that owns everything. It's a teaching on godly giving and stewardship, getting our hearts right. The B, that's what I'm going to teach about budgeting. And again, I know budgeting is the bad word of money. We don't even call them budgets. We call them personal financial freedom plans. But I promise you, I'm going to show you a 9-step plan that will rock your family's life forever on a budget, change everything, and get husbands and wives to quit doing this sort of stuff. And the C, that's what I'm going to show you how to control your money by building what we call a wolf barrier. It's a 10-stone wall to keep the wolf away from the door forever. How to pay off that short-term debt, everything but the house, in 1 to 4 years. How to develop the emergency fund. What to do about insurance issues. What to do if you should suddenly lose your job. How do you become a long-term giver to God? What do we do about paying for college? How do we get ready for a dignified retirement? There are 10 stones in all, and when you stack them correctly, the wolf just can't get to the door. Now listen, as we break huddle here, let me just say this. You're welcome to visit me. I've got a booth up here. It's booth number 203. It's down at the far end down there, 203. We've got materials there, and I'll be glad to talk with you if you want to discuss maybe doing a seminar at your church. I've got some materials we'll give you. I do want to tell you about one thing. And this book, along with CDs of the entire seminar, are up at the booth. But I want to tell you, those of you that are in the class, I do this when I come to special events like this, and it's just for those of you that are in this room. This book is $19.99. It's a $20 book usually. It's a 350-page book, 19 chapters, and like I said, this is really the soup-to-nuts book. Everything about money, how to get out of debt, how to develop the spending plans, what to teach the kids, how to give like we should, the car buying, the home buying, the insurance issues, how do you invest correctly, how do we pay for college, how do we find great bargains, how do we negotiate better deals. This pair of shoes, well, these aren't the shoes, but I've got a pair of shoes just about like these at home. I went in the mall the other day. They were $115. That day they were on sale for $88. I paid $65 for them. There's a whole chapter in here on how to negotiate better prices. When we do that, we save a lot of money. Anyways, this book is normally $19.99. I have some copies of it up here at the front. Those of you that are in this class, if you would like to get a copy of this, you can have one of these for $10. So just come and see me right after we get through here if you'd like one. Let's bow our heads. We're going to talk to the Father and we'll break huddle. Father God, thank you so much for bringing us together. Thank you for loving us so much. And Father, please just help us to realize that the ones you've given us in this world are the ones that we need to love the very most. Father, keep us homesick for heaven. Bless us as we're at the workshop and bring us back together tomorrow. In Jesus' name, amen. By the way, I would mention that if you happen to have a kid between the age of 12 and 52, this is a good gift.